from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a beautiful weekend in Melbourne, Australia, whence this broadcast is originating. And there are so many questions that an American brings to Australia at this point in time, such as, why did you guys get suckered into the same deal we got suckered into? Or why did your prime minister apparently not tell the truth in his last election campaign about a mysterious charge that refugees trying to make landfall in Australia and therefore receive asylum threw their children overboard, allegedly, the so-called children overboard scandal. So those are, you know, contentious and troublesome questions for an American to bring to Australia. But, ladies and gentlemen, let's cut to the chase. There is one question, whether politically savvy or not, that every American wants answered about Australia. And it just so happens I'm in a position to answer that question today. Radio probably isn't the best medium to bring you the answer, but it's the only one I have access to at the moment. So here, as live as it can be, from Melbourne, Australia, you can bear oral witness and answer it for yourself as you listen to the sound of my toilet flushing in Australia. There, that settles that. Hello, welcome to the show.
Because you look so fine that I really want to make you mine. I say you look so fine that I really want to make you mine. 4, 5, 6, come on and get your kicks. Now you don't need the money when you look like that, do you, honey? Big black boots, long brown hair. She's so sweet with her. Gonna be my girl. Well, it's 1, 2, 3. Take my hand and come with me because you look so fine that I really wanna make you mine. I say you look so fine that I really wanna make you mine. 4, 5, 6. Come on and get your kicks. Now you don't need money with a face like that, do ya? Big black boots, long brown hair. She's so sweet with her. I said, are you gonna be my girl?
part is, the funny part is, my husband right there all along. No more tears and no more sighs and no more fears. I'll say no more goodbyes if trouble beckons me. I swear I'm gonna refuse, I'm gonna settle down, and there'll be no more blues. Every day while I am far away, my thoughts turn homeward, forever homeward. I travel around the world in search of happiness, but all the happiness I found was in my hometown. No more blues, I'm going back home. No more dues, I'm through with all my wandering. Now I'll settle down and never roam and find a man and build a home. When we settle down there, then no more blues, nothing but happiness. When we settle down there, then no more blues.
From the Antipodes, from Melbourne, Australia, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And if you didn't think the toilet flushing was, as the lawyers like to say, dispositive, how about the water running down the sink? See that? It's true. They don't lie about this stuff, ladies and gentlemen. They lie about the other stuff. This is Melbourne, Australia. And, well, might you ask, are the Olympic Games as unwatchable in Australia as they are in the United States? And the answer is no. They don't have nearly as many. I haven't seen any up close and personals. I think that's because in a country of 18 million or whatever it is here, 20 million. They're already up close and personal with these people. They know them. They don't need. In the village of Tulkuk, there were no poles. There were no pits. So a dream had to be carved after a journey of hundreds of, you know, none of that. They know that story already. Or they don't care. Or if they care, they care in some other. They come caring. They come to the television already caring. That's the point. Or, my theory, Australian television isn't as crazed about making sure that women watch the Olympics, which is why they do that in the United States. They do all that stuff because they found, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, that the Olympics being, in those days, of course, sports, women didn't watch it. We didn't watch the games as much as men did. And given the escalating rights fees, they had to get every pair of eyeballs they could whatever was whatever those eyeballs were attached to in the plumbing department. So hence, I think, rhythmic gymnastics, synchronized swimming, and a dream begins in a village. All of that. So they don't do that here in Australia. But what they do is argue incessantly. They really care. They really do care. Coming down here, it was amazing to find that Olympics are and have been front page news on every newspaper since the game started. You'll page through about half of the paper of the front section before you get to anything other than the Olympics. And of course, there's a special Olympic section in addition. And the front page news this past week, for much of the week, has been the story of Sally Robbins. Now, I'm sure that's not a household name in the United States or probably anywhere else in the world. We in the United States are probably busy in the household word department, household name department, dealing with Stephen Marbury and Lamar Odom. Hey, we're busting our buttons in L.A. We got Lamar coming to the Lakers. He's going to bring that Olympic magic with him. But in Australia, Sally Robbins has dominated the airwaves this week. She was a member of Australia's 8-woman rowing team. And in an event, I guess their final event in the Olympics, that team was not in contention for a medal in any case at the point that this event happened. But Sally Robbins stopped rowing. She just, in the middle of the race, I think two-thirds of the way through the race, actually, she just stopped, let go of her oars, and leaned against the adjacent, I think, the person in front of her in the boat. And the country went bananas. And by the way, they do grow their own bananas in Australia, so they don't have to import any to go bananas. They went homegrown bananas. And the airwaves were full of, do you blame Sally? Do you blame the teammates for attacking Sally at the end of the race? They just rounded on her, as they say here. Do you blame the coach for putting Sally on the team? Because now it turns out this isn't the first time Sally has done this. Do you blame the sports psychologist the team hired to help Sally with her problem? She said she just ran out of gas. But apparently the tank has sprung a leak before. So the Sally Robbins story has dominated Australian media. And the real tragedy for the girl at this point, she's I think 23 or 24, is that she is not an American. So this will probably be the last we'll hear of Sally Robbins, unless the rumored affair that she was having with the coach turns out to be true, in which case there'll be another week of media frenzy about it. But were she an American, of course there would be, contrary to what Fitzgerald said, there would be a second act to the Sally Robbins story, because with all this notoriety, you just know that within 2 weeks, you'd see Sally Robbins on American television saying, "Hi, I'm Sally Robbins. I quit. But your battery doesn't have to." And now, ladies and gentlemen, the Olympic saga continues. Athletes may be at the center of attention at the Olympic Games, but don't expect to hear directly from them online or see snapshots or video they've taken. The International Olympic Committee is barring competitors as well as coaches, support personnel, and other officials from writing first-hand accounts for news and other websites. An exception is if an athlete has a personal website that was not set up specifically for the game. The IOC's rationale for the restrictions is that athletes and their coaches should not serve as journalists, and that the interests of broadcast rights holders come first. Participants of the games may respond to written questions from reporters, or participate in online chat sessions, but they may not post journals or blogs until the game's end. To protect lucrative broadcast contracts, athletes and other participants are also prohibited from posting any video, audio, or still photos they take themselves, even after the games, unless they get permission ahead of time. The editor of a website that had arranged to publish athlete diaries called the restrictions short-sighted. "This is unfathomable to me," says Robert Blyweiss, editor of Duke Magazine, Duke University's student publication. "I don't understand what the International Olympic Committee might be concerned about. It's a way to engage a wide audience with reporting from the field and therefore generate excitement and interest in the games," unquote. His site had made arrangements with two graduates, pole vaulter Gillian Schwartz and race walker Kurt Clausen, to provide first-hand accounts for the university's alumni. "This is a means to personalize the Olympics, to excite a constituency with the thrill that comes with the knowledge that a couple of their own are participants in the competition," Blyweiss said. An IOC official, speaking to the Associated Press on condition of anonymity, said sites like Duke's are covered by the restrictions. The Olympic guidelines threaten to yank credentials from athletes who are in violation, as well as to impose other sanctions or take legal action for any monetary damages. The official said the IOC has yet to take any action against an athlete. Don't look for Olympic blogs. This will get the $7 billion back for the citizens of Athens, ladies and gentlemen. And we will never know why Sally Robbins ran out of gas, at least until after August 29th. Hey, that's today. Sally, call me. These comments not authorized by the International Olympic Committee, who's still waiting for the Bush-Cheney 04 campaign to take their Olympic commercial off the air.
Esconde a cidade, você some. Será que é? alegria da noite, eu não sei. As horas cessaram naquela manhã que vem. E é outro dia será um desencontro. Vou sozinha, ele não dá um sentimento. Será um jogo intenso que se anuncia. Ele ri, sabe o que faz. Esquece pra minha vida todo o tempo. Esperei e a vida agora está.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is Book Bag. Book Bag, chit and chat about the fascinating world between the outline and the remainder bin. I'm Ira Zipkin. Summer is book time, and it's also time for ice cream. So it's appropriate, perhaps, that on today's Book Bag, we're double dipping. By which I mean we're playing host to two authors, each of whom has a new book contending for that prize position on the beach blanket next to the ice chest. Robert Bloom is an old friend of the Book Bag, longtime baseball editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine, and author of more than 36 books about the game. Robert, that hardly seems possible.
I know, Ira. It amazes me.
And Olaf Arsenault is a newcomer to these precincts, best known up to now as the host of the popular public television cooking show, The Norwegian Cajun. And now he's starting what he hopes will be a franchise of books that amuse as well as inspire. Olaf, welcome.
Thanks, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here in such distinguished company. I guarantee you that.
The flattery will get you on the comp list. Olaf, tell us how you came to write Gumbo for the Soul.
Well, Ira, you're familiar with the very popular Chicken Soup for the Soul books, eh?
I think they're neck and neck with the Left Behind novels as America's most popular series of books,
yeah. If
you want to call them that.
Well,
I don't know. Is that elitist? I don't think so, but enough about me.
Well, as you know, that series presents folksy inspirational stories that teach you lessons about life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, down where I come from in Southwest Louisiana, we don't like our books or our soups bland. I and my lawyer, Chip DeLesseps, we came up with the idea of gumbo for the soul, which are somewhat, spicier stories that still carry an important lesson about life. But, you get a little hot sauce with your inspiration there.
Helps the medicine go down, does it?
No, that's sugar. Yeah. Even where I come from, Cher, you don't put hot sauce on your medicine. Yet.
Well, given an aging population, it might be good for the hot sauce industry. But back to your book, you made reference to spicy stories. Could you give us a sample from Gumbo for the Soul?
Sure. This is the story of the gator, the priest, and the 8-year-old boy. No, that's too spicy. Here's a warm and wonderful story about a child prostitute in Bangkok who learns to bake when she... No, that's a little spicy for radio, too, there.
Well, why don't we just turn to our other guest, and you can scan your book for a story that's spicy but not too spicy.
Yeah, good luck to me there.
Robert Bloom, you've become famous and beloved for your elegiac portraiture of baseball, not just the game, but, and I don't think you use this locution, but the metagame.
I don't, Ira, but it's really the only pretentious locution I don't use.
Well, you're being facetious, of course, but there's an underlying truth there.
If, in fact, the truth can underlie.
If, indeed. Your latest book of baseball elegia is called The Boys of Andro.
Mm-hmm.
Explain.
Well, Ira, a lot of the sports writers have chosen to treat the subject of steroid use in baseball as a scandal, as something tawdry and shameful and somehow not in keeping with the game's traditions and standards of sportsmanship.
Mm-hmm. Of course, most recently, the two Greek-American baseball players who were disqualified over this sort of thing.
Exactly. They're treated as if they were criminals purely for the act of trying to increase muscle mass and stamina.
Well, but
fortunately, I never conceptualized myself as part of the sports writer fraternity, so-called, so it was possible for me to take a different, more nuanced look at the whole subject. The result was the boys of Andro.
Mm. And Andro refers to...
I thought you were going to finish that sentence.
I did, too, but...
Now, I know, it's a hard name to pronounce. Androstenedione is an anabolic steroid. It came to prominence when Mark McGwire started hitting that profusion of very powerful home runs.
So you took a non-judgmental look at athletes using drugs?
Just baseball players and just steroids and related compounds. Mm. If a basketball player or track star wants to smoke or inject something, that's somebody else's book. One, by the way, that I don't particularly want to read.
Give us a sense of the flavor of The Boys of Andro, if you could maybe read a bit of it for us.
Sure. The heart of the book is spending a year following a player I call Tito as he goes through his training regimen on the substances and observing its effect on his game. This is from Chapter 2. Turinabol, Dianabol, Android, Nandrolone, Oxandrin, Anadrol, Winstrol. These are the names of some of the more popular steroids. After a while, after you get over the strangeness of the sounds, like becoming used to the cadence of Dominican ballplayers' names, it begins to sound like nothing as much as the most formidable starting lineup since the 1927 Yankees, a veritable murderer's row of the bloodstream. As Tito opened his locker down in Florida, or was it Arizona, to me that spring morning, the jars of pills and powders glowed with the promise of renewal. The brazen labels holding out baseball's perennial covenant of a new beginning, always with the hope that this year would be better, that the seed of this nascent season would sprout into more power, more speed, more muscle mass. Tito flashed a boyish wink and downed three of the elephantine pink tablets. A fierce February breeze ruffled the center field flag, but not Tito's confidence. "It's time," he said. "For batting practice?" I asked. "No, dude," he said, laughing. "For an injection."
Hmm. He called you dude. Mm-hmm. And Florida or Arizona was so...
To protect his anonymity.
It gives you a whole different perspective on steroids.
Ira, it's part of the game. You know, there's a reason that baseball resists drug testing its players. It's the same reason that they didn't give Babe Ruth a breathalyzer test.
Which was?
He would have failed it. Mm. I mean, you don't go to Cooperstown to see pictures of the Bambino in a 12-step program.
No, I guess you don't. Olaf Arsenault, any luck in finding a spicy story from Gumbo for the Soul that you can read on the air?
Well, there's the Boy Scout and the Dominican nun. He's very inspirational, No, I don't think I could read the last page on the radio. I know I couldn't read it on public television. They stopped taping during the Herring Jambalaya segment.
Well, then I guess we'll all have to read it for ourselves. Gumbo for the Soul by Olaf Arsenault and The Boys of Andro by Robert Bloom. With books like these on offer, you could only wish summer lasted longer this year. Thank you both. And for now, it's time to climb out of the book bag. We had help today from the girl who found the men's room key. Support for this program comes from the Gutenberg Foundation. Type moves you. I'm Ira Zipkin, inviting you to join us next time we slip into the book bag. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
Satisfy me except you and the baby of the color. Santa's and the goods are all right. He's at home now counting the dough. I'm standing here for another last throw. You quiet me down. Been all over the place and I ain't found anyone. Keep my feet on the ground. Oh. Can't be bigger than my old habits. Oh, my dead body, but still.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
First up, former Lieutenant Governor Ben Barnes of Texas.
I got a young man named George W. Bush in the National Guard when I was Lieutenant Governor of Texas, and I'm not necessarily proud of that, but I did it. I got a lot of other people in the National Guard because I thought that was what people should do when you're in office and you helped a lot of rich people. And I walked to the Vietnam Memorial the other day, and I looked at the names of people that died in Vietnam, and I became more ashamed of myself than I've ever been because it was the worst thing I did was help a lot of wealthy supporters and a lot of people who had family names of importance get in the National Guard. And I'm very sorry for that, and I'm very ashamed, and I apologize to you as voters of Texas.
Barnes could not be reached for comment. On Friday, the apology adds a new layer to a role he acknowledged in 1999 during Bush's first presidential run. Barnes confirmed in a written statement that he had, at the request of a Bush family friend, contacted a Guard official to ask that Bush be allowed to enlist. Bush and his family said they never requested any such help from Barnes. Barnes has never said the Bushes contacted him about the matter. But he is now officially sorry. Dateline Milwaukee Miller Brewing Company apologized for failing to include black artists on its commemorative rock and roll cans. The brewer did not include a black artist in the 8-can series. The cans are part of a summer promotion with Rolling Stone magazine celebrating the 50th anniversary of rock. Critics questioned how Miller could have overlooked black artists' role in the development of rock music. Quote, African Americans obviously have played a formative role in the development of rock and roll, and despite our efforts, we did not manage this component of the promotion appropriately, the company said in a statement. The company apologized to the African American community, to music fans, and to our valued consumers. The cans did feature Elvis Presley, Blondie, Alice Cooper, Willie Nelson, and others. Dateline Washington, a top Homeland Security official, has apologized to Senator Edward Kennedy, who was stopped at airports last week because a name similar to his appeared on the government's no-fly list of terror suspects. Quote, if they have that kind of difficulty with a member of Congress, how in the world are average Americans who are getting caught up in this thing, how are they going to be treated fairly and not have their rights abused? Kennedy asked Homeland Security Undersecretary Asa Hutchinson, former head of the drug war. The Massachusetts Democrat said he'd been misidentified on the watch list when he tried to board airliners between Washington and Boston. He was stopped 5 times as he tried to board U.S. Airways shuttles because of a name similar to his appearing on a list or his name popping up for additional screening. Hutchinson apologized for any inconvenience to the senator. A similar name confusion occurred to Democratic Congressman John Lewis. An expletive muttered under his breath in a taped segment that mistakenly got on the air has ended Robert Flores' career. in Austin, Texas, as a TV sports anchor. The brief blunder was broadcast before sunrise this past Thursday, and Flores, who was not on the station at the time, was fired that day. He learned the wrong tape was aired as he was driving to a University of Texas football practice. "I'm embarrassed that it made air," Flores said. "I take full responsibility, but obviously it wasn't meant to air. I've got two young children. That's not the kind of language I want them to hear. I want to apologize to anyone who may have been offended." The circumstances surrounding the telecast are still unclear. Dateline and Jaff, fighting intentions mounted Wednesday evening ahead of Ayatollah Sistani's return to the city. The nervous police department raided the Najaf Sea Hotel, where most of the foreign and Arab press corps were staying. At 9 p.m., dozens of armed policemen kicked down doors and fired weapons indoors before leading reporters away in pickup trucks to the police station. There, Police Chief Ghalib al-Jazari criticized journalists for reporting on Sistani's peace initiative. Mr. al-Jazari later apologized for the rough treatment his men had given journalists. Quote, "Let's not forget they're under huge stress because of the night attacks on the police and the American raids on the old city of Najaf. I hope you'll excuse us," he said, "for our behavior." Unquote. The mayor of Muncie, Indiana, renounced his decision to include the American flag in a ban on flags at a city-run campground this week. In an open letter to campers at Prairie Creek Campgrounds, Mayor Dan Kanan said he was reversing his prohibition on all flags. Quote, "I sincerely apologize to you for any inconvenience or stress this issue has caused," Kanan wrote. "Men and women have fought and died for our flag, and my decision was wrong." Police officials distributed copies of the city's complete flag ban on Monday to those at the campground along Prairie Creek Reservoir, about 10 miles southeast of Muncie. That order from Kanan broadened a previous rule that had exempted the American flag and POW/MIA flags. He said Monday he'd consulted with attorneys and decided to widen his ban to bolster the city's defense against the lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union. However, he changed his stance following protests from campers and others. Quote, "I now realize my decision was made in haste and was an error on my part. Since the issue of the memo, I have painstakingly reflected on the issues surrounding the policy. I regret yesterday's action." Taxi and limousine commission officials say this week their agents had acted somewhat overzealously in arresting Mike Wallace and that the disorderly conduct charge against him would be dropped. You remember August 10th, he was handcuffed and taken to a police station by two inspectors after questioning inspectors who were questioning his limo driver. Alan Fromberg, a spokesman for the commission, said the inspectors, quote, "could have chosen other, better options." The inspector with the handcuffs, Keith Roman, was not yet authorized to carry them or to issue a summons. A rookie inspector, Mr. Roman had not received a special patrolman designation from the police department, which typically comes a few months after the inspectors finish their training. Mr. Roman insisted to investigators that Wallace lunged at his partner, Richard Metagliano, a veteran inspector, but Fromberg said investigators interviewed several witnesses and concluded that Wallace did not lunge at anyone. Roman and Mr. Metagliano, who were placed on desk duty, will be issued official warnings and forced to undergo retraining on conflict resolution. Wallace reached at home, said the commission's chairman had called him and was very decently apologetic. Wallace said, referring to Mr. Roman, quote, "the man made a mistake, and I think he's been made to understand that by his superiors," unquote. Dateline Kabul, Afghanistan, the U.S. military apologized this week for the deaths of three unarmed Afghans shot by American troops after their pickup truck failed to stop at a road checkpoint, and they promised to look into ways to better safeguard the civilians there in Kabul to protect. Afghan's president, a U.S. ally who has complained in the past of heavy-handedness by American soldiers, called for a full investigation into the killings and termed the unarmed victims, quote, "martyrs." Says U.S. military spokesman Major Scott Nelson, quote, "we are very sorry. This is a dramatic tragedy, and three people were killed." It was the first apology from the military, which last Sunday said only that road checkpoints were important for security and that anyone approaching them had the responsibility to stop. Just a couple more. An assistant principal of Grayson High School in Gwinnett County, Georgia, near Atlanta, pulled Terrell Jones out of class Monday, mistaking his Hempstead, New York 516 logo T-shirt as a reference to marijuana. Jones moved to Grayson from Hempstead. He had to persuade school officials to look up the town on the internet before they let him go back to class. The assistant principal apologized once he realized the misunderstanding, said Susan Roach, spokeswoman for the county schools. Jones got to keep his shirt on. Though he could not be reached for comment, the Associated Press reported he says he will wear it to the school in the future as well. Hempstead, ladies and gentlemen, Hempstead. And finally, in the apologies of the week, Hamilton County, Ohio, prosecutor Mike Allen admitted this week he had a 37-year extramarital affair with a female lawyer who works in his office. Allen, a married father of two children and one of the county's leading public figures, said he made the relationship public because he thinks a lawsuit might be filed against him by the woman. He asked for forgiveness and said he will not resign. Quote, "What I did was wrong, hurtful to myself and my family," Allen said in an interview. "I made an error, and I'm making it right with my family." The announcement was a jolt not only to Allen and his family, but also to a successful political career that had been built around law enforcement and family values. Allen has aggressively prosecuted obscenity cases and has expressed moral outrage over a wide range of issues, from clergy abuse scandals to the arrest of a Cincinnati man who photographed bodies at the county morgue. He says he doesn't expect his affair or the public's responses to it to change the way he does his job. "I've never said I'm the moral conscience of the community," Allen said. "Does it help me? Certainly not. But I don't think it affects my job." Attaboy. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
It's time now for the Health File with Dr. Manfred Weitschner. In addition to being a New Age internist with a practice in Arcadia, Dr. Weitschner has a degree in forensic broadcasting from the University of Leipzig. Dr. Weitschner.
Thank you very much, Tim, and welcome, dear listeners, back within the capacious confines of the Health File. You know, friends, in the years that we've been emphasizing the mind-body connection, nothing has come to mind or body so frequently as the evidence that this really is the way we are all wired. And evidence is accumulating faster than unanswered emails in the digital bowels of the Health File. Just this week, the respected British medical journal The Clamp reported on a study indicating that people who liked what they saw on television had healthier immune systems compared to the grumpy gusses that watched more in sorrow than in pleasure. Will this someday lead to a world where you can sue the networks if you develop acute pleuropathy? I don't know, but maybe I should go back to law school.
You're listening to The Health File with Dr. Manfred Weitschner. Dr. Weitschner welcomes mail from listeners, but healthfile.com is currently being blocked by some internet spam filters. Once again, Dr. Weitschner.
Thanks, Tim, and we do want to take just the merest moment to say that Tim's book, Announcing for Dummies, is currently available in paper bags. Sorry, that should be in paperback. In the sensory messages we get once we leave the Manila Sanctum of the Health File, nothing is more ubiquitous than the television commercials for what the computer savvy might describe as Viagra 2.0. From propounding a cure for what we used to call a flaccid penis, the pharmaceutical industry has now migrated to selling length of time as well as the other kind. We've all heard mention of the peculiar side effect, erections lasting more than 4 hours, requiring an immediate administration from the doc. But a physician in nearby Tarzana says this may be a more serious problem than it sounds. Dr. Tracy Banerjee runs the Erectile Emergency Center at Tarzana St. Luke's Metaplex. Dr. Banerjee, welcome within the multicolored dividers of the Health File.
Thank you.
You've stumbled across a whole new syndrome, haven't you?
We call it APPAS, Dr. Weissner.
APPAS. A-P-P-A-S. That would be... What would that be?
Acute Prolonged Painful Arousal Syndrome. That's mm-hmm. the state that these medications are inducing.
You've seen a lot of four-hour episodes, Dr. Banerjee?
Dr. Weitschner, in all seriousness, have you ever seen a waiting room completely filled with male patients experiencing severe, unrelieved tumescence?
Back when I was in the Peace Corps, I did see something like that in Mozambique, but it did have a completely different etiology.
If I remembered my college medical anthropology, they would have also been profoundly scarred.
You recall it correctly. Mm. Dr. Banerjee, what's prescribed for the, and you'll pardon me, the growing number of patients who appear to be presenting with an excess of presenting? More fresh fruits and vegetables, another powerful pharmaceutical, or just megadoses of vitamin L for love?
Well, my point, Dr. Weissner, and I will answer that question. My point is simply that no physician I knew had ever been confronted with this situation before. I really had to embark on a trial and error process to come up with a therapeutic regimen that isn't drug-dependent, because a lot of these patients really have shut their paychecks on the medication that put them in this situation in the first place. Now, on a physical level, the goal is to reduce blood flow to the affected area. On a psychic level, of course, to reduce feelings of arousal.
Which, given the mind-body connection, will itself contribute to hypohemia.
So, in combination with a low dose of aspirin...
For its blood-thinning effect?
That's correct. There's a precisely timed exposure to anti-arousal imagery.
Oh, and these would be?
Well, the most efficacious materials are proprietary. Mm. But some more common examples would be still panoramic images of a barren desert, a program of severely out-of-date agricultural news features, and black-and-white footage of mature women playing field hockey.
And the need for precisely timed exposure would be, aside from the obvious...
What would be the obvious?
Just the desire in the scientific realm to provide for repeatability of results?
That obvious, yes. Mm-hmm. But the reason in this regimen is that a prolonged exposure to even the strongest anti-arousal material will have a contrary effect in a certain percentage of the patient population.
Mm. These would be what in an earlier day would have been referred to as weirdos.
That's correct.
Dr. Banerjee, can we expect to see more erectile emergency centers as the advertising wars heat up for these powerful party extenders?
Well, that's entirely up to our investors. We're ready to roll it out as soon as the funds clear, because, believe me, Dr. Weissner, the smiles on the faces of these patients post-treatment is worth more than money.
Not that much more.
Maybe not.
As the ads say, if the moment is right, you might not be ready, but at least you will be sparing yourself a trouser-popping visit to the doc. Dr. Tracy Banerjee, as usual, our thanks for a first visit to the orderly vicinity of the Health File. I hope it's not your last.
I'm sure I hope so, too.
And so, dear friends, I thank you for listening. I wish you mega doses of vitamins. See you next week. And now, so long from within the fast closing panels of The Health File. So long.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to read the trades for you. This is from TV Technology Magazine, a trade publication serving the broadcast cable market. Lawmakers do the shut-off shuffle. I'll read it for you. Dateline Washington, the onus of nailing down a hankered-for hard date for shutting down analog television signals is coming down to converter boxes. Lawmakers across the board have long speechified about a hard analog television shutdown date, but there's little consensus on what that date should be and how to get to it. The House Telecom Subcommittee sent the Government Accountability Office to Berlin to study the analog shutdown there. The GAO subsequently reported that the key to Berlin's digital transition was encouraging households to purchase set-top boxes or digital televisions. In Berlin, that encouragement consisted of telling people their TVs would no longer receive broadcast signals as of August 2003 without a converter box. The poorest households received a subsidy to buy a box. Berlin shut down analog signals 10 months after digital transmissions began. U.S. lawmakers are flustered that 8 years after digital broadcasting commenced here in the United States, analog shutdown appears to be nowhere in sight. In all of Germany, television is primarily a public entity funded by a mandatory monthly fee, which is waived for welfare recipients and low-income households. Consequently, the logistics of providing converter box subsidies in Berlin were built into the socio-economic structure. At the Lessons for Berlin hearing, attended by a handful of lawmakers last month, the primary difference between the German capital and the United States became progressively clear, i.e., the United States has 60 times the number of television households and is 11 million times larger than Berlin. Greg Schmidt, Vice President and General Counsel at Lynn TV, testified that Congress should subsidize converters for every household with an over-the-air set, which made Representative Rick Boucher of Virginia somewhat incredulous. Should owners of analog sets be held completely harmless, he asked Schmidt. Schmidt, yes. Boucher, the means test in Berlin involved people eligible for welfare. Schmidt, we believe everyone should be eligible for a subsidy. Boucher, your estimate of over-the-air sets, 45 million? Schmidt, if anything, it's conservative. The cheapest converter boxes available now are around $300. That's $4.5 billion at $100 subsidy per. Every time we try to estimate the proceeds of an auction of the spectrum made available by analog shutdown, we are usually wrong, Boucher said. Dramatically wrong. Interesting admission from a congressman, ladies and gentlemen, when I read the trades for you. Isn't it? Ladies and gentlemen, from the buried lead department, about two-thirds of the way down in a story in Sunday's New York Times about George W. Bush running his own presidential campaign, this, quote, 2 weeks ago, after learning that John Kerry said he would have voted to authorize the president to invade Iraq, even if he had known that Saddam Hussein was not armed with weapons of mass destruction, the president jumped at the moment. Quote, that was a mistake. We need to seize on it, Mr. Bush told his aides. The next day, he began hammering Mr. Kerry on the issue and has not stopped. That's right, the problem is George Bush is dumb. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe. You send 440 cable system in Japan, around the world to the American Forces Network up and down the East Coast of North America on the shortwave giant WBCQ the planet, around the world via the internet at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, and available as a free download at www.audible.com/the show. And it would be just like the water going down the drain the same way all over the world, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much, The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Next week, from New Orleans.